Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Royal Automobile Club talk show in association with Motorsport. I'm Ed Foster, and I'm the online editor of Motorsport magazine. What a special hour we have lined up. Not only do we have the return of Jack Phillips, our online content assistant, we have Anthony Davidson. Anthony, a very, very warm welcome.
Thanks very much. Yeah, good to be here.
Apart from being Formula One driver, winner of the World Endurance Championship 2014, you are also the winner of that year's Tourist Trophy. And we're sitting here in Pall Mall in the club today. You're sort of here for quite a special evening. What's going on this evening?
Well, we're here to celebrate the Tourist Trophy. In combination with the RAC here in Pall Mall and the WEC in a combined effort to celebrate that amazing trophy and just motor racing in general, which it's with Silverstone coming up for the first round on Easter weekend in Silverstone for the WEC, our opening race of the championship. It's a great way to celebrate it.
So I mentioned that you won the Tourist Trophy in 2014, and that's obviously for winning the British round of the World Endurance Championship. Obviously, when you're a driver, winning the race is the most important thing. But these extra accolades, things like the Tourist Trophy, I mean, they must be quite special as a driver to get sort of not just the Winners' Cup, but also that socking great big trophy.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, being a Brit myself, it's easy to appreciate. But on that day, my two teammates, who one's from Switzerland and the other from France, they didn't really recognize it. They didn't know what it was all about, so I had to explain it to them. You know, it's the oldest trophy in motorsport. It's really something special. Some really famous names on there. So to join that elite few that have been on the engraved on the trophy side is amazing. And we lifted it with pride all together that day. I wouldn't say it's a cherry on top. It's something that means more than that. When your racing career is done and you look back at it one day, you tick all the highlights, I guess, and that would certainly be one of the highlights in having your name on a trophy such as that.
Why do you think there are so many? I mean, there are loads of British drivers in sports cars at the moment. Is that because of a particular era of drivers being so strong and they haven't sort of quite, it hasn't worked out for them in Formula One? Or why are there so many British drivers in sports cars? Because there are loads of them, which is great, and it's really good to see. But is there some secret to it? Why aren't we seeing them all?
We must be so accommodating, I guess, as people, as a nation. You know, it fits well in sports cars where you have to be selfless, I guess. But I don't know. F1 is a egotistical series where only the strongest survive, and I think maybe there is. You know, I was joking, but maybe there is some truth to it in that. The Brits are quite accommodating, and we're good team players, and I think that's really what you need in sports cars. Formula One these days, it's taking an awful lot of money, like it's always done, but even more so than ever before. And maybe, you know, LMP1, LMP2 is now seen as a true ladder to get to Formula One, so you can highlight your talent in sports cars as that progression into F1, whereas maybe a few years before it wasn't. Before it was a world championship, I think it didn't have as much accolade and recognition.
When is the point where you think, I'm now a sports car driver, rather than, so all the young kids now coming through swapping their single seaters for sports cars, when do they reach that point, do you think, when they're now a sports car driver?
There's no definitive answer, I guess, for that. For me, it was easy. The F1 dream ended when my team pulled out and the money wasn't there. I had no personal backing, and I was mid-20s anyway, or late 20s actually. And you know, after ringing around the teams, and I think then Toyota pulled out as well, and there were basically more drivers than seats. And I just thought, you know what, it's time to look elsewhere. So for me, it was quite easy. I felt like I was on the older side already in Formula One, and I'd given it a good go. And you know, under unfortunate circumstances, I was left out in the cold, really. But I think for younger drivers coming through, it's a harder question to answer. I think you just have to grab the opportunity when you can in Formula One. And if it's not there, and if it looks like it's not going to be there, you have to look elsewhere before it's too late, and then you're forgotten.
I think it's interesting that actually quite a lot of drivers at a very young age now are saying, I want to drive sports cars, which is, I think it's good to see, and certainly it's good for the World Endurance Championship, and there's drivers recognising the calibre of drivers in the championship at the moment. So that is good
well,
to
when
see.
Well, when I first joined sports cars, I called it the secret of motor racing, the secret formula of motor. You know, nobody really knew about it, especially the younger drivers. I mean, when I was a kid, I knew of Group C, but I wasn't as fanatical about it as Formula One. I didn't really watch any races. I knew that the cars looked cool. And it was a hard, you know, particularly Le Mans was a really special, hard event. But I didn't, I didn't follow it avidly, like a true fan, like a bobble hat. But I did in Formula One. And I think since it's become a fully fledged world championship, it's seen as, that's kind of secret formula has gone. It's now very much in the spotlight.
Yeah. And I'm going to start off with a couple of sort of less positive points, but don't worry, it's going to get more and more positive as we go through the podcast. We're going to be dancing on the tables to sort of Highway to Hell by the end of it. So at the end of last year, the breaking news was Audi pulling out. First of all, A, did you see it coming when, you know, as soon as Porsche came in, the sister mark? And secondly, you know, how big an impact is that on the championship? Because they've been there so long. They're the team that everyone always sort of aims to beat, and there's now just Toyota and Porsche left, really, in the LMP1 class.
Yeah, well, it's not the first time in my sports car career that I've just been there with the two manufacturers to fight each other. When I was with Peugeot, it was Audi, and now with Audi gone, it's Porsche. So the sole VAG group remains. I can't obviously speak on behalf of them. It's their decision at the end of the day, and. It's a bit of a double-edged sword, really, manufacturers being involved in sports cars or Formula One or any category of racing. It's brilliant while they're there. It's terrible when they're not. You have to ride the crest of the wave while it's good. And we had a great couple of years with the three manufacturers. I managed to luckily win the championship when there were three manufacturers. It kind of gives it, for me, it was a bit more personal pride, really, the fact that you had conquered two manufacturers rather than just the one. It ebbs and flows, and you know, manufacturers will come and go. It's part and parcel of motor racing, and as long as there are a few around it at any time, that's a good thing. And it's good that such manufacturers like Porsche and Toyota are attracted to WEC at the moment.
How did that Audi battle evolve? Because every year seems slightly different. The car would have slightly different characteristics. One would be better. Did that feel like a different year every season, or did it all merge into one long battle?
Having raced them since the Peugeot days, like I say, I've really seen the sport change a lot, not just in terms of the regulations, but in terms of the professionalism between the teams. I think when Toyota first joined, they bought this, all the knowledge from Formula One. You could really see they were a fresh Formula One team. To try their hand at something else, or to retry their hand at something else, I should say. And you could see that where Audi and Peugeot used to be, Audi then had to step it up to Toyota's level in the aero department, the engine department. You know, they really had to raise their game. And then Porsche joined, and everybody else had to carry on raising their game, because it's that's just the nature of the beast. It's, you know, people come in full of energy, throwing everything at it. And it's been really fascinating to watch the series grow and grow, and to be a part of that as a driver, and the technology that evolves every year is sensational. It really is. I mean, we don't talk about it enough. We're not allowed to talk about it enough. It's a shame, but that again, it's part of motor racing, that when it's at that level, it's secret business.
I have a section on some of the technology, so I guess that part is going to be a little bit shorter than I foresaw.
Not going to get much, yes.
The final sort of less positive question I've got, we can't go anywhere really without talking about Le Mans 2016, the sort of the most gutting result for a team I think there's been in all the sort of recent decades, certainly, and you know, and probably it'll be in the top 10 of the history of motorsport, I think, or even the top 5. I've got a question here from Nick Holland, who wants to ask, how does it feel of being robbed of that Le Mans victory, and how do you follow it up? Does it increase your desire? Does it, I mean, how long does it take to get over?
It's a good question. I knew the question was coming. I mean, everybody, to answer it in a blunt way, everybody has a coulda, woulda, shoulda story from Le Mans. That's that race. You know, it's a long old race. Lots of things can happen at any point. And it's, in a way, it's more gutting when you lose the race very early on, because then you have to get back in the car when it's fixed and then endure the whole 23 or 22 hours of knowing there's no hope, in a way like we did in 2014. And there was no hope of victory. Somehow we managed to get a podium out of it, but you were never going to win the race. And that was the hardest Le Mans I think I've ever done in 2014. But we bagged those valuable points for the championship, and which we then focused on later in the year and eventually won. But, you know, in terms of coulda, woulda, shoulda stories go at Le Mans, I think I've pretty much got the best one. So I'm kind of yeah, happy and sad about that. How long does it take to get over? I'm really still not over it. And I think even if I go on to win it another 3 or 4 times, I'll still remember 2016 as really that one that got away.
A lot of some drivers would say that Le Mans is so important they'd give up, you know, the world championship for it. Would you put yourself in that camp, so you'd swap 2014 for a Le Mans victory?
No. Because the way I kind of got through last year is to tell myself that it's a one-off event. As grand as it is, a lot of it's down to luck, as we all saw last year. You can really, on paper, have all of the credentials to win it. You can do everything you want to win it, but if it's not meant to be, it's not meant to be. Where to win a championship as a driver or any athlete in the world competing, to put together a world championship and win it is much harder than doing that one. Although yes, it's a whole day of racing, it's still just one day of racing, rather than lots of different circuits, lots of different permutations, weather conditions, different scenarios of traffic to deal with, different handling characteristics of the car and the different tyres and everything else you have to combat through a whole season of racing. For me, as a sportsman, that's much harder to come out on top of. And it proves that you were the best. Through the whole season, you were the best on average. Whereas that one race, well, you can fluke it.
I was going to say, there are some obviously fantastic drivers who won Le Mans 24 Hours, but there are also some who probably didn't deserve to win the Le Mans 24 Hours based on talent alone. So, you know, it's as you say.
Well, I mean, it's a tough one. Yeah, I mean, everybody deserves to win it if they do stand on that top step. I mean, you know, last year we, as a team, we threw it away. As unfortunate as it was, and as unlucky as it was, well, from a team's point of view, it wasn't really that unlucky, because the team can control reliability. A driver can't control reliability, maybe like they could have done in the olden days. So from a driver's point of view, yeah, it's unlucky. But as a whole team, well, it wasn't really unlucky. It's unlucky in a way when it happened. It's unfortunate. But, you know, these things can be controlled from a team's point of view. And just like a driver can control not going off the track. So the guys that ended up winning that race that day, well, none of them went off the track. None of them did anything crazy or silly. And they all deserved, as drivers, to stand on that top step. You know, our car crew deserved to stand on that top step. We didn't do anything wrong. But as a team, a whole team, we did do something wrong. And that's why we didn't win it. So, yeah, it's just all we needed is one more lap. And if they had built that car to do 23 hours and 57 minutes or whatever it was, they did a really good job. But we need 24 hours. So it's, yeah, that's just, you know, looking at it very pragmatically, that's the answer.
Does it make you fall a little bit out of love with the race?
I'd done that a long time ago. Oh, yeah. Yeah, I've done it enough times to have fallen out of love with the race a long time ago. And you know what? I got the best out of myself last year by, and it's no disrespect to the race whatsoever, the way I got the best out of myself is treating it like a 24-hour go-kart race for charity. Because I just thought...
Blimey, remind me never to invite you on a 24-hour charity go-kart race.
You know what? It's just... I just approached it last year, and I'll do the same thing again this year. And even what happened last year concretes the fact that I approached it in the right way last year, in that anything can happen at any time in that race. As long as I do my job, you just see how it all unfolds. And, you know, I drove the wheels off the thing, don't get me wrong, but it's because I was loving it. Because I didn't care about it, I was loving it. And if you go into that race really het up, like I've done in the past, wishing you're going to win it and give it everything you've got, and oh, you're going to be so depressed and disappointed if you don't win it because, oh, I need this in my CV so much, you know, you're never going to win it, and it's going to eat into you because it is a cruel race. So approaching it like I did last year, for me, it worked. Maybe for some others it wouldn't. I'm really pleased. I think that is the best I've ever driven in a sports car race last year. In Le Mans, and I want to approach it in exactly the same way this year.
Right, on to more positive things. I was going to talk about the hybrid systems and things like that, which we will do, despite the fact you're not allowed to talk too much about them. There's a question here from Stephen. Something you did win, Formula Ford Festival in 2000. He was saying it was one of the best defensive drives he's ever seen. How important was that win for your career?
Yeah, I think it was pretty pivotal. It was a great race. It was a defensive drive. Basically, to cut a long story short, it was wet the whole way through. We had the car to do the job in the rain, in the Miguel French chassis that we were driving at Hayward Racing, and against the Van Diemens, the Works Van Diemens, and it dried up for the final. So I was there on pole position. I'd been creaming it easily all the way through the weekend. The race was mine, and then it dried up, and everyone went into it in the unknown, but I kind of suspected the Van Diemen's going to be strong, and they really were. And I just had to defend every single lap. I'd seen how it should be done from other races I'd done previously around that track, and I think if anyone wants some tips on how to defend around Brands Indy, I'm the man to ask, because I did it from start to finish. Ended up with bent wishbones from them trying to smash me off, and it was pretty epic. The race even got red flagged with just five laps to go, and they restarted it. It's like, come on. So we all started again, and the same thing happened again. There were damp patches on the track, and we were on slicks, and it was pretty sketchy, but across the line, it was more relief than joy, I think. I was being watched by the BAR team at the time. They were just starting their young driver program. They were pretty impressed with, a Formula One team only cares whether you win or not. They weren't there to see it. They just want the phone call, we did the job. So we could ring and say, we did the job. And I got onto their young driver program from that point. And the rest is history, so...
Formula Ford racing is some of the best racing in the world. You know, it was so great to watch, especially at Brands, when you can kind of see so much of the circuit.
Anywhere. I look back so fondly on Formula Ford. Yes, they had no grip and they were pretty skittish to drive. And maybe you adopted some skills that you never really needed to use ever again in your career, like heel and toe and an H-pad gearbox. But it was, it was really hard to drive. And the best thing about it, by miles, no wings, lots of slipstreaming, the leader could never get away. And there's something to be learned from Formula Ford for that.
On that note, what do you think about the new Formula One rules? Talking of no downforce and no grip.
Well, it's exactly what I was suggesting. It's, if you go put in big wings on cars and generate lots of downforce from the wings, well, the wings need clear air to work efficiently. So as soon as you get behind this kind of invisible barrier of no man's land behind the car that you can never get to because the wings won't work when you get into that kind of bubble, you're never going to have pure racing, and you're going to need to rely on things like DRS as a band-aid to try and get your way past the car in front. So Formula Ford, and in a way sports cars as well, because we don't have the big wings, it's a lot of it's from ground effects in a sports car, You know, you generate the grip in a different way, and therefore the racing is more organic, it's more pure, and you don't have to rely on kind of what I would say gimmicks.
Yeah. So looking at this year, let's talk about this forbidden topic of technology. The rules have been sort of quite static for a while, but could you just sort of explain in a few sentences the hybrid system on the car? Because it's not the same as Formula One, but it's extremely complex, cutting edge. So for a layman like me, what are you driving?
We're basically driving a souped-up Toyota Prius. That's basically what it is. It shares a lot of the same.
It's
got to
be sexier than that.
I don't know. Have you seen the Super GT Prius? That's pretty sexy. Yeah, I must say. you know, so it's essentially, yeah. I mean, it is similar to the Formula One system, particularly the Porsche system, I believe, because they run the heat recovery as well, the turbo. Effectively charging the battery at high speed. In Formula One, they've got their set of regulations. In WEC, you're allowed two recovery systems. So Toyota choose to run a front electronic motor and a rear electronic motor to harvest the energy under braking, so kinetic energy. Whereas Porsche opted for a front electronic motor and the turbo or the heat recovery. So that's their two options. So achieving a similar thing, but in a different way. And so our system is more favourable for heavier, longer braking circuits, i.e. Le Mans, whereas the Porsche system and the F1 system can regenerate a bit of charge to the battery at high speed when you're flat out. It starts to sap the energy from... It effectively turns off the turbo, and then that energy goes into the battery, as far as I am aware. That's how their system works. So it is incredibly sophisticated. It's complicated, but it is fascinating. You know, for a driver like myself that's technically minded, I love technology as a whole, and to drive these cars that have this huge battery delivering massive power, almost half of what the combustion engine will give. Is incredible with 8 megajoules around Le Mans. You really feel it when the battery kicks in, when it deploys. You know, at the beginning of the straights, it really is. You know, it's 1,000 horsepower combined, there or thereabouts. And despite the weight of the car, you really get a good kick. And it's really fun to drive, knowing that when you're braking, you're recharging all that energy. It stores it up super quick. You know, you can never believe how quickly they're able to regenerate energy into the battery these days, and the technology just keeps evolving more and more and more. And this technology is there in road cars, and what we learn on the track, it really genuinely does. Not just saying it for PR BS reasons, it does. You know, they're learning from it, and it's filtering into the road cars.
What was the first hybrid car that you drove? Because I just want to know what it was like when you came from sort of normally aspirated F1 and then drove a hybrid car for the first time.
It was the Toyota.
So it was
That was the first hybrid. I tell a lie. It was the Honda F1 car just before they pulled out. I drove it at a straight line test in Santa Pod, and I had the KERS button. And I remember feeling just this little bit of extra power from the battery. And then, when you think where it's come from since that day, that would have been back in end of 2008. It's progressed more than tenfold. It's incredible what they can do now.
How do you think Lopez will get on, obviously jumping straight into this Toyota from...
Well, he's done quite a bit of testing. Yeah. He's an adaptable driver. I mean, we saw when he did touring car coming from single-seaters.
Yeah.
I think that for him probably... not that I want to speak on behalf of him, but it was probably a bigger challenge driving this front-wheel drive car than in touring car with no grip, and you know, that must have been really different, a different experience going from open-wheel single-seater formula in I think GP2 he came from, and then going into touring car. That must have been really difficult. It's almost for him, I guess, it's like coming back home. Although he's got all the tricks to learn with. The hybrid stuff from inside the car, but a lot of it is automated these days.
It's quite rare to jump straight into LMP1. So Mike Conway did P2, and a lot of drivers work their way up, but he's coming straight in. It's going to be quite an interesting year for him.
Yeah, it will be. I think the biggest challenge, the biggest shock to him will be traffic management. Gone are the days for him where you can just get your elbows out and have a bit of a ding dong. It's even if you get close to another car in P1, your bodywork falls apart, and they're pretty fragile machines compared to what he's been driving. But he'll be fine. Anyone that's won what he has in the past and succeeded like he has, it's going to be easy for him, I think. But it will be an eye opener the first time at the prologue. It'll be the first experience he has of, wow, this is a jungle out here. I'm gonna have to survive this.
Yeah. A lot of drivers sort of complain about the traffic, and GT drivers aren't perhaps as sort of experienced as they should be. But isn't that part of the charm of Le Mans? I mean, I think it's easy to say charm when you're a spectator. When you're in an LMP1 car fighting for the lead, it's probably not charming. But
some of it is when you get into a rhythm of where you overtake the cars, where they're slower than you, where they're almost as fast as you. Even a GT car can be as quick as you in some of the slow speed corners. They've got amazing mechanical grip, and especially in slippery conditions. So learning all of the different teams and drivers out there and categories is part of sports car racing. Nobody likes it. It's difficult. You all have to share the same track. You all have a bit of road rage every now and again. I've done Le Mans in a GT and in P1, and two very, very different experiences. It's a bit like being, we're here in central London. It's a bit like being either a cyclist at 1 minute on the road or then in a white van. It's, you all have to get on, and you all want to get from A to B, but it's, as long as you appreciate each other's challenges that lie in front of them, you just have to respect the fact that there will be moments where you touch each other and things go wrong, and that it will be someone's fault at the end of the day. But some of it is really unavoidable. It's just, I think I worked out once that you overtake roughly 500 cars from your journey starting Le Mans to the end as each individual driver. And to overtake 500 cars
in eight hours of driving, the average white van man wouldn't do that in London. No.
I say I've seen more drama on the way here driving a car through London than what I do at Le Mans. But so there is that challenge there, and you things will every now and again it will go wrong, and I think that has to be the skill of the drivers from all categories has to be applauded for how little that actually comes to light.
Yeah. Sorry, just 1 second. You mentioned the GT car, but that was Ferrari 550.
Yeah, he drove. He's done his research.
Did you mind thinking that you didn't particularly enjoy that, Le Mans?
Well, I was kind of just on the brink of getting into Formula One properly. I was a test driver, had been for a long time, and the reason it came up was through the Pro Drive connection, because David Richards was at BAR at the time. So I had the opportunity to do Le Mans. Looking back at it now, I should have done a lot more racing when I was a test driver. Although it was a bigger job than it is today, or it was a job back then. you covered 15,000 kilometres in a year testing, so it really was hard work. But still, I should have done more racing, and I'm glad I did that race. Not that it ended well with a car in the barrier with a broken front right wheel bearing, which sent me off. I'll still never forget Darren Turner for that. Thanks, mate. Never told me about it, never warned me about it before I got into the car. But I wondered what that weird noise was when I got in down the pit lane. That was my first visit to the Le Mans hospital. They remembered me, actually, when I went back there in 2012. And they were broken back. You've been here before. So it all looks the same when you're on your back. Because the ceilings, I don't know. But I'm glad I've got that experience to fall back on. And I think in that year, I was looking in the mirrors more than going forwards. I was kind of petrified out there, not being in the fastest class, always having to accommodate for the faster cars, and always being on guard for when they're going to strike, pop out from into your mirrors, and they're there the next minute in the corner, diving down your inside. So, in some ways, in some ways because I managed to stay out of trouble and maybe I was too accommodating. I'm a little harder on the GT drivers when they don't see you coming, because that day, that 24-hour race, I really did see them coming. I lived in the mirrors, like I say. But then, you know, you are dealing with amateurs sometimes out there as well, or gentlemen drivers, and things can go pretty wrong through no fault of their own. It's like being on the road with a learner driver. You can't really, you know, you can't put 100% blame on their side, because they're not at your level. They haven't got your capacity, and therefore you shouldn't treat them like they've got your capacity. So I've almost got less tolerance for the pro drivers when something goes wrong than for the amateur drivers, and I can't blame the driver that clashed into me in Le Mans in 2012. I can't blame him 100%. It's just the race. You know, those things happen.
I was going to ask that, really, because it was mainly his fault. And
Perazzini, wasn't it? Yeah. So, you know, but, you know, at the end of the day, it's like you crash into a learner on the road. It's although it might be their fault, it's you can't blame them. You can't be as hard on them as you would be if it was a pro driver, say.
Did you find it difficult to trust for the next race? Did you find it difficult to, were you sort of find yourself looking for them after that?
Yeah, definitely. And I still find it hard to overtake into that corner today, but I learned from it. You know, the mistake I made was going too far over to the right-hand side before the corner and probably got into his blind spot through, again, no fault of my own. I was thinking I'm safer if I get away from the car as far away as possible. But actually, I've learned since, it's better to be closer to the car before going into a corner like that, because they've got more chance of seeing you. Especially if they're a left-hand drive car like he was. So, you know, I think if you don't learn from situations like that, then it will happen again. And I make sure that I try not to overtake into that corner, especially today with the fuel cuts that we have. It makes it incredibly hard to judge closing speeds. Like it was back then as well, although we didn't have the fuel cuts, it was a new car to me. They're always tweaking the regulations, and I don't think it's appreciated a lot of the time what an implication that has, a knock-on effect for the drivers out there in how we have to then recalibrate for all the different categories and the car that we're driving for those different situations that you find yourself in. So I was approaching him still with my Peugeot head on, and in those I would have made it. I would have made the gap easily and been in front of him, but in a car that had a different set of regulations and hybrid, and I think they had tweaked the regulations for the GTs as well. You combine just a few different tweaks of the regs here and there, and it can be sometimes a recipe for disaster.
So on a lap at Le Mans, you're looking at GT drivers. You're obviously trying to concentrate on your race and your pace. How busy are you with the hybrid systems? You mentioned that some of them are automated, but it's not just a case of throttle, brake, steering and gears, is it? There's a lot more to it.
Yeah, there's a lot more to it. The driver's more in tune sometimes than the engineers are. You can see the information on the screen quicker than what they can sometimes, or expect the situation that might arise from a battery that's too fully charged or too depleted. Different things can happen to your car if you get into those situations. And basically, as everybody runs hybrids more and more, they're learning that to keep the battery in this kind of happy equilibrium of temperature and charge gets the best out of it. So, you know, that's what you're always trying to do and manage on the track. And say in Formula One, it's easier to do because they have less... They've got bigger storage for what they actually use, what they need in Formula One. So they charge and deplete the battery a lot more slowly than, say, the Porsche system and our system would in P1. We stress the battery much more than an F1 car would with the 8 megajoules that we're running at Le Mans. So to keep the battery in that kind of happy equilibrium is quite a challenge, not just from a driver, but from the team's point of view as well. So we're on top of that inside the car. You know, we can change the way that we brake. We can change the way how we put our foot down in the corners and where we decide to lift and coast for the fuel cuts that we have. So although there are quite a few kind of automated systems around hybrid technology in racing cars these days, the driver can still have a huge impact and influence on how you can sort of store the energy and use the energy.
Do you think that's why the sports car drivers in Formula E are often seen to at the front, because they're used to dealing with all the batteries and everything they need to keep an eye on? So Wemmy can just drive off into the distance.
I mean, he wasn't the only one, although he is very intelligent at stuff like that. Probably is one of the reasons why he's so strong in Formula E, but you know, other drivers do understand it as well. And you know, Lopez is, for example, he's doing Formula E and he'll be learning a lot there, and I think it's there's a crossover definitely between what you do in Formula E and WEC, and you know, vice versa. So yeah, they, as long as there's a battery involved somewhere, a driver's going to be knowledgeable on how you store the energy and use it. A
bit of an awkward calendar this year as well.
it's a series, you know, I'm interested in. I like I say, it's said before, I like technology, and you know, I know pure electric cars don't float some people's boat, but I respect it as a series. And at the end of the day, you know, it's a racing car with four wheels, and it's, you know, there is an engine there, and I think, you know, some great drivers, and it shows that the good drivers from WEC do well in Formula E. And vice versa. It's, you know, I think it's a good series, but there's a clash of the calendars, and I see Seb and the other guys, you know, Jose, struggling with their calendars, and I sit back just laughing sometimes. So I think, well, I'm glad I'm just doing WEC.
it's interesting. Sometimes I ask talk show guests, you know, what their favourite era of racing was, or if another era they would have liked to have competed in. But I get the impression that actually you're competing in your, you know, preferred era, because you love the technology, you love the hybrid systems, and okay. Whenever you were racing, you thought it would have been cutting edge. And I'm sure in 40 years' time, they'll look back and maybe listen to or watch this podcast in virtual reality or something and say, God, Hans, you know, you would have loved it now. Am I right in thinking that it's, this is kind of the era for you, the cutting edge?
Well, you know, different people have enjoyed different generations of motor racing through their lives. And, you know, I grew up in the 80s watching Formula One. So I've seen the turbo engines they had back there, and then going to normally aspirated, and the V10s, and then I've seen the slicks and the groove tires, and lots of dependency on big wings in Formula One, and then the introduction of hybrid cars, and although some people they don't like it, I've followed it from the beginning, and I think every single iteration that comes along, I'm just more and more fascinated by it. You know, I don't remember feeling disappointed that the original turbo era went in Formula One, and I enjoyed the sound of the cars back then when they went to the normally aspirated engines. Not that anyone was complaining about the sound of the turbo engines in the first place in the 80s. I never remember my dad complaining, oh, these things sound awful. But I enjoyed when they went to the normally aspirated. It sounded cool. They looked good. And then aero technology really started to develop, and that was fascinating, watching all these winglets springing up on the cars and how much faster they could go with lap times, and it was all because of this aerodynamics that nobody really understood back then. And it's become so powerful in racing now that almost it's to its detriment. And I think maybe that now needs to be detune slightly and find the grip somewhere else in sake of finding better racing or more pure racing. And I think that's what I get in sports cars. You know, I get the chance to sit closely behind the car in front and really pick your line carefully to know where you're going to pounce or not. And actually, the regulations of having fuel cuts for us, although some people don't like it, they don't like the idea of, oh, you're saving fuel by lifting and coasting at the end of the straight. Well, actually, like I said before, it gives you a tool to use inside the car that is up to the driver's discretion where you use the override of the fuel cut. And this makes some fascinating moments on the track. Because if you're going into a place where you know you're racing the guys who's going to get the fuel cut the same as you, if you press the override and you happen to use more fuel into that corner, well, you're going to get him or her. And then you're going to pull away on the exit of the corner. But they know that you're going to get that cut, a bigger cut, somewhere else on the lap. So it is organic. You know, you're still, you've still got the same energy allowance for the lap, but there's no DRS involved. So for me, that's still pure. And later on in the lap, it's up to you to defend your situation, and they've got more fuel coming later on than you have. And mixed with the traffic as well, that's what makes the sports car racing so fascinating when you're behind the wheel.
Yeah. Group C was basically a fuel-limited formula, you know, so, and people always look back at Group C and say, oh, God, what a mega era. And, you know, I think there is always a case of rose tinted glasses in motorsport.
I think we just know more now as well. As, you know, I speak as a fan. I've been there watching the Melbourne Grand Prix. And speaking as a fan of the sport, we're just way more informed today as well. And it's how you deal with that information sitting on your sofa. You either embrace it or and always trust that whoever's behind the wheel, it's still about skill. Whether it's a skill that you appreciate or not, you have to appreciate that it is a skill. Like heel and toe used to be a skill, it's not anymore. You know, things come and go.
I don't know. It's
I can't remember the last time I heeled and towed a car, but yeah, you know, it was a skill for me in my career at some point. It's not anymore. But I've seen people struggle with flappy paddle gearboxes, and it's just a different skill.
Yeah. Now, it's obviously the championship battle this year is between yourselves and Porsche. Is there a, I mean, obviously we haven't had even the prologue yet, and the first race isn't until next month. But do you have a sense of where you're at in terms of the development and where you might be in terms in relation to Porsche, or is it just a complete unknown? I mean, surely you must hear rumours and know bits and pieces.
Little bits and pieces, but it really is a bit of an unknown. You know, you can kid yourself sometimes. Think like we did in the 2015 season, that we had a really nice car. We'd just come off the back of a championship. The car still felt pretty similar to the last year's car. You know, we had a bit better hybrid system. The car had more grip slightly. The aero was more cleaned up, a bit more sophisticated. And we really thought we were going to be at least in there with a shout. And we got blown away. It was just, yeah, I mean, you just don't know sometimes. But, you know, we nearly won Le Mans last year on merit. We had the car to do it there. We were competitive at other circuits through the year. We won Fuji again on merit at the home race. And so I think, you know, if we can build a car at least to that level, we're gonna be right there with Porsche. The car at the moment feels good. That's all the driver has to go by. The way that the car used to feel compared to how it does now, but we've had quite a significant tweak again of the regulations, and who knows who's read it right? I don't know. In the same way the F1s went to Melbourne, no one really knew. We all suspected Ferrari had a good package, but we ultimately, a lot of people didn't believe they could actually win the race like they did. So we like to believe that we're there at this point with Porsche. I think it's good to not expect any more. To level your expectations, and then you can only be pleasantly surprised, and that's the better way to approach it, rather than thinking you're the big dogs and you're going to go there and destroy everybody, and then you get completely trampled on. That's not a good that's always hurts even more.
That year, I think Toyota made about 3 seconds a lap improvement, but then Porsche made 6. Sure, that it can't happen again.
Well, now knowing what we know about the battery system compared to our old supercapacitor system, we all knew. The first time I drove the battery system, I just laughed out loud in the car, because I could feel what we were fighting against all last year, you know, in 2015. And with the regs, at least from the powertrain side of things, staying the same, it would be... It's almost impossible to imagine that kind of speed difference happening again in terms of the powertrain side of things. You know, we're both at 8 megajoules now. Back then we were at 6 versus an 8. So, you know, you're on a level playing field in terms of megajoule allowance for the lap, at least, like we were last year. And just from that alone, I think we should be, you know, hopefully there'll be a good fight.
Yeah. Now, if we were doing Le Mans, we would be approaching sort of lunchtime on Sunday at the moment. We are nearing the end of this talk show, but I wanted to take another question here. This is from Rockingham Slot. I'm guessing that's not his or her real name.
Slot Cars, I think.
Slot Cars, right. Is there a reason behind the driver combos? He's saying, I presume driver combos have a similar styles, and well, you know, because obviously that's useful when you get up to the setup of the car, or do you just compromise on setup? And I mean, how much thought goes into the driver combos?
First, you pick the driver that doesn't pee in the seat. They're out straight away, and then you go from there. No, it's basically a Toyota. Most of the time, you just get put together. You know, the team decides. You get put together. It's very rare that the drivers have a say in who they would like in the team next to you or not. When you're signing contracts as a driver, it's every man for themselves. You get the contract. You're happy to be there, and then you kind of get told where you're going to end up. And it's only when you get established in the team that then you can start to maybe decide who you would like with you. That's only happened very, very rarely from drivers that I know. But yeah, you know, drivers come and go like teams come and go, and you kind of, you know, I used to be Wirtz's teammate in Peugeot, and we won races together, big races like Sebring, and then you arrive at Toyota. He was already there, established, and I arrived there kind of like in the second car, and so I wasn't his teammate then. And some readjusting goes on, but like I say, it's when you get the contract and you get into the team, you can't be fussy on who you want to be with.
Yeah. How difficult was it when you first came into sports cars to sort of share the car? Because for Formula One, or single seaters in general, actually, is an extremely sort of selfish sport when it comes to the driver, because it is all about you have to be the most comfortable you can be in the car and have the car perfect for you. Some drivers, I think, find it quite easy to then step in. You accept what it is. And other drivers find it quite difficult. Where do you sit on that scale?
Well, I was always quite a good team player from where I came from. My background as a test driver, I was always doing the donkey work for the race drivers, setting the cars up, giving them all of the information you could do in a debrief. They jump into the car and they get the glory on the race day. And so I was kind of used to being a real good team player, and maybe settled into that role slightly too well.
Too British,
maybe too British. Like I joked about at the start, you know, I was very accommodating. So I found it really easy, and actually, I much preferred it. You know, as a person, I much preferred being in a less egotistical kind of atmosphere, and really working with a team of drivers. And that the camaraderie between the drivers, on top of the working relationship you have, and the sharing of success or defeat as a trio of drivers or a duo, whatever it will be at that time, it's like when you see football players celebrate together. There's more elation almost when you win than when it's just yourself. It's quite a lonely experience sometimes in F1 or as a single-seater driver. When you win, it's great. You feel brilliant, and it's great for your CV and everything, and a few people come up and say, well done, and you get the accolade from the fans and the respect, but you don't. There's no one else feeling like you, and that's the brilliant thing about sports cars, that there are at least two others that feel exactly what you feel.
Yeah.
And it's cool. So, yeah, I like that side of it. And some drivers are more egotistical when they come to sports cars. There's a lot of
non-Brits
adjusting, yeah.
Yeah.
Some Brits as well sometimes, so yeah. it's really fascinating to watch the drivers that struggle, and even drivers that you could pick from Formula One that you know would struggle more in a sports car environment than not naming any names. You can see the ones that would struggle more in a sports car environment than and it's not just from sharing the car with teammates, it's how you behave as a driver, as a person, almost within the team. You can be very destructive if you rock the boat too much in a sports car team. It can change the whole atmosphere from having a bad egg there.
Yeah. So fascinating answer. I've never heard it put so eloquently.
Thanks very much.
Yeah, no, lots of people sort of talk about it, but it's, yeah, beautifully put. So what I've tried to do over the last few talk shows is ask some quite standard questions to each of our guests. They're not too difficult, don't worry. They're not sort of on the detail of Toyota's hybrid system. First one is, you've got one car and you're going to take it to a track. What are you taking and where are you going?
One car, well, race car.
Race car. Let's stick to race car. Could be something that you haven't even driven.
You know what? Yeah, I would like to have a go in a modern F1 car, just to see what they feel like, how the powertrain feels compared to what I drive, to feel this massive grip that they have today. If it wasn't one of those, it would be probably the V10 Honda or BAR, whatever it was back then. When I was test driver 2004, they were really quick cars as well, and maybe to compare the two of those, you know, the modern F1 car versus the 2004 car, to see how they would line up. But I'd probably go for the modern hybrid car just to see what it's all about.
I see a motorsport cover story coming up. So where are you going to take them?
Where would I take that car? I mean, I've never, believe it or not, I've never done the Nordschleife in anything.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. Only on the video
even
game.
I've been around the Nordschleife.
Yeah, though. So you're one up on me.
Look at me.
Yeah,
wow.
Yeah. I'm sure I'll get loads of offers now to drive anything.
Well, I'm pretty sure we've got Mercedes and BAR on the phone right now, actually, wanting to do a back-to-back test.
So, but I think, yeah, I'd leave that one because it would be a bit brutal on the car around there. Some fantastic circuits. I was only speaking to somebody the other day about Elkhart Lake, Road America, and I think that would be a pretty special track to drive anything around. But yeah, particularly a modern F1 car or sports car, that would be a good experience.
Yeah. Right. So the second one, who has inspired you the most during your career?
I was always a fan of Alain Prost. I liked his style. The typical ones of Senna and Mansell, and basically that was my era growing up, and they were your heroes. You know, they were doing something you would just love to do when you were a kid, and almost when you get there, it's not special anymore. Back then it was, I admired the way that Prost drove, so conservative but extremely quick as well at the same time, and I think people forget that how closely he ran Senna and actually could often destroy him on the day. He was better than what people give him credit for,
and he did
it in such an effortless way as well. That's a big skill to make it look easy. But it never is.
You'd have been perfect for sports cars as well.
He would have been, yeah. We could have shared a seat.
Was it Murray Walker who said famously on the commentary, Alain Prost is slowing down? Oh, no, he's not. He's just broken the lap record. I think it was either him or Mansell. Anyway, second last one here. Was there a specific moment when you knew you wanted to be a racing driver? Was it watching the likes of Mansell, Senna and Prost, or was there a moment when you suddenly thought, hang on, I want this to be my career, this is it?
No, not to get into karting. I was too young then. You know, as an 8-year-old kid or 7-year-old kid, it was my dad's ambition and drive to get me and my brothers into karting, because he could never afford to do motor racing himself. So for him, it was, it ticked all the boxes of, he would, it was cheaper to run, to get your kids into it, and kind of live motor racing through the kids, and watch them develop as drivers and learn what it's really all about at grassroots level. So I never really, I didn't sit there watching TV, watching Formula One, listening, getting weaned on Murray Walker. I didn't sit there thinking, I want to do this one day, I have to get into a car. You know, I was playing football at the time, for my local club, and winning trophies there, and that was kind of my thing. And then one day I just found myself at the local kart track at Rye House in Hoddesdon and having a go for my 8th birthday, and you know, that I was driving around then. I can't really remember it, But that's how I got into racing. But I do very much remember specifically the point when I remember thinking, this is what I want to do for the rest of my life, and I'm good at it, and I know I can make a living from this. And it was when I was 14 years old, doing junior TKM, and it was at the Open Championship in Bucknell Park that I went on to win that day. And I remember thinking, yeah, I know I'm good enough to do this forever. And that was the defining moment that really nailed it for me, winning that race that day. Then I remember going to school and they were talking about, you know, what you want to do as a career prospect and stuff. And I was single track. I knew what I wanted to do. And I definitely, from that moment, didn't give school enough attention. If only there were hybrid systems around back then, I would have been fascinated at school.
Am I right in thinking that you were sort of quite happy in karts, though? And actually, that making the step up to Formula Ford was not something you particularly sort of had in the front of your mind. It was something that developed, and obviously you excelled straight away, winning first six races and finishing on your pole.
You remember better than I do.
It's strange, that, isn't it? For a lot of races, it's as soon as they start karting, it's right, where's the top? Formula One, okay. Whereas with you, you wanted to get to the top of the karting, which you didn't, but then you were quite keen to stay there.
Yeah, it was a weird one. I mean, the dream was Formula One. To get to Formula One when you're a kid, you know, the dream to get to Formula One when you're doing karting was strong. I think I'd done karting so long, I could sort of see it becoming my future just in karting. I had no backing from anybody. I'd seen my old sparring partner, Jenson Button, move on from karting into Formula Ford and thinking, oh, it's never going to be me. He's the lucky guy's found the backing and off he goes. That's great for him. But I wasn't so disappointed in thinking my future's in karting. You know, I was a paid professional kart racer doing world championships, driving for an Italian team, living in Italy. It was great stuff. But when the chance came, I knew I had to take it. Even though I was a little bit apprehensive, I think, at first, thinking, oh, Formula Ford, you know, it's going to be hard then to come back to karting. If it all goes wrong, what am I going to do? But, I'm glad I did it, because at the time I thought, look, well, Jensen's gone and done it. He's done well. You know you're at his kind of level. You have been through all the early years in karting. There's no reason why you can't replicate what he's done. I made the jump when luckily found the backing, and never looked back.
It's worked out all right, to be honest.
It did work out all right. It's all right.
Right, the final question, because I'm not going to say 23 hours and 57 minutes through Le Mans, but we are approaching that time. If you weren't a racing driver, what would you have been? Footballer, perhaps, I don't know.
I don't really know. It's too hard to... I do get asked this... I have been asked this a lot in my career, but I never know, because doing something from an 8-year-old kid, it's all you've ever known. I enjoy the technology, that side of things in racing. I probably would have done something in programming or some kind of tech, I reckon. Maybe like graphic design or something. My dad's a traditional sign writer and graphic designer. I probably would have got into business with him and been the sort of computer side, because he was the traditional sign writer, like I say, and had to by himself make the jump almost to the computer age of signage and stuff. So I probably would have been the one to set up with him and be the computer bod sitting next to the old man. But I don't know. I mean, that's probably what would have happened, but I'm glad it didn't.
There are many fans out there who are also extremely glad that it didn't happen. Anthony, thank you so much and best of luck this year.
Thanks very much.
Here's to another World Championship and a Le Mans win. Jack, thank you very much for joining me and asking sort of sensible questions. Alan, thank you so much for recording this, as always. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you so much for watching. We'll be back very soon with another talk show. We'll see you all then. Bye-bye. Thanks for now. Bye-bye.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.